Welcome to the Melungeon Voices podcast, presented by the Melungeon Heritage Association. My name is Liz Malone, and I'm here with the president of the fine organization, the MHA, Heather Andalina. Good hump week, Heather.
Yes, we're about midway through.
Episode 4 is always our hump episode. It means we are right in the middle of our season. And I have to say, I know we're in episode 4. Is it just me? This is going by pretty fast, like every season it seems like, right?
Oh, yeah.
So getting back on track, let's talk about what we have going on for this week's episode.
Yes, Liz. This week we speak to Ron Carson. And let me tell you a little bit about Ron.
Please do.
Ron Carson is the founder of the Appalachian African American Cultural Center. He has dedicated his life and work to the collection and preservation of the narratives, experiences, and artifacts of historical import to the Black people of Appalachia. Along with his wife, Jill, he prevented the demolition of an old one-room schoolhouse he'd attended as a child, and in 1987, created the Appalachian African American Cultural Center within its walls. In this week's episode, we welcome back Ron Carson. He was a guest speaker at this year's Melungeon Heritage Association Union Conference. We further discuss the African American experience in Appalachia and how the Melungeon people are a part of Black Appalachian history, and his important work advocating for the diagnosis, treatment, and benefits for coal miners with Black lung.
Ron's presentation from this past Union Conference was dynamic. It was certainly a crowd pleaser, a lot of information, a lot of heart. So I am truly looking forward to hearing what you and Ron discuss this week.
Yes, Liz, and that's why we chose Ron to be the connection between the conference and the podcast season this year.
Well, as they say, you chose wisely. Thank you, Ron, for speaking at the conference and, of course, being on the podcast. And let's all listen in.
Hello, Ron. How are you today?
Hello, Heather. I'm doing fine.
Good, good. So I'm going to get right into it. This is usually how I always like to start my interviews, is having our guests tell us about their personal ancestry and if they have any ties to the Melungeon people.
Okay. Well, this is Ron Carson, of course, and I was born in Pennington Gap in the early 1950s. Actually, I grew up in Pennington Gap until the age of 17. Then I moved away. But growing up in Pennington Gap, I grew up during the segregated era where Blacks and whites just didn't mix. And my great-great-grandmother, Rachel Scott, saw the need for a building for the Black children to go to school in. So she actually provided the resources, had the color, as they call it, elementary school, built in 1939. My great-great-grandmother, Rachel's, my mother was the first group in 1940 to enter that building. And I was in the last group in 1965 when we integrated. So my roots run very deep in Southwest Virginia. We actually came to this area, what I found was in the early 1800s. I would have been a fifth generation coal miner if I had stayed in the coal mines, but it just wasn't meant for me to work in the mines. So I lasted maybe 2 or 3 months, and then I left right after high school.
Would you please share some insight into what is the African-American experience in Appalachia?
I'm not sure if it's any different than any other place in a deep South, I guess, during the area that I grew up in, during the segregation. We weren't allowed to go into any establishment. I recall going to the movie theater. You know, I had to sit up in the balcony. I couldn't sit down on the auditorium floor with my white friends who we played together every day, softball, basketball, but we could not go into the drugstore and have a milkshake together. We couldn't go to the movies together. So the first 12 years of my life, I was born in 1953 and we didn't integrate until 1965. So the first 12 years of my life, you know, were segregated. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, the Appalachian African-American experience. We just didn't know any better because we were there in the mountains and we really didn't know how the other side of the country were living during this time.
Interesting. Let's talk about the Appalachian African American Cultural Center, which celebrates, preserves, and teaches Black Appalachian history. Ron, tell us about how it came to be and what is the work of this organization?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Heather, my great-great-grandmother, you know, built this building in 1939, and it served as an education center for Blacks. From 1939 up until 1965. From 1965 up until 1986, it served as a Head Start Center with the Lee County School System. In 1986, I had lived in Boston for a great number of years, and I had moved back to Pennington Gap, Virginia. And at that particular time, the Lee County school system was consolidating schools. They had built a new school, and they were going to tear down all the other little schools that didn't serve any purpose. So I knew that my great-great-grandmother had built this building, and there was never a reversion clause in the deed that it would revert back over to the family after it stopped being used as an education facility. So we knew that we had a battle ahead of us fighting the school system. But anyway, couple years fighting the school system for the building, we finally got the building. And we really didn't know what we wanted to do with the building. We had no idea. I just knew that my great-great-grandmother provided the resources for it to be built, and I didn't want to see it tore down. My wife and I, Jill, we got a fellowship to the Highlander Center in New Market, Tennessee. And if your listeners are not familiar with the Highlander Center, it's a place where during the civil rights era that groups of people would go and meet and plan strategy. Actually, it was where Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks met several times to plan the Montgomery bus boycott. So we got a fellowship called the SALT Fellowship, the Southern Appalachian Leadership Training Scholarship. And it was there that we discovered that very little had been written or documented on African-American in the coalfields of Southwest Virginia. Nothing had been written. Dr. William H. Turner did a book earlier called Blacks in Appalachia, but it really didn't focus a whole lot in the coal fields of Southwest Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and Southern West Virginia. We knew that we wanted to start documenting the stories of this forgotten area. I heard a quote by Dr. Carter G. Woodson, and I always paraphrase him, where he said, perhaps the most important element to any given people is the documentation and preservation of their history. If a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition, and it stands to be lost in the eyes of society forever. And that just stuck with me over the years, because I knew nothing had really been documented on Blacks in the coal fields of Southwest Virginia. So we started this process back in the 80s. We had this big old camcorder, the first one that came out. So we got a couple young kids to carry the camcorder around. And we knew that we had to start gathering these stories because we were an aging population in Lee County and the surrounding counties of Southwest Virginia. So if you think about it, 1987, 86, 87, when we started this, you still had people who were born in the early 1900s, or maybe even 1898, 1899. And they could tell stories of their parents, of their great-grandparents. So we started documenting all these stories and gathering this information. We had what was called story swaps. We were trained by the Apple Shop to facilitate story swaps. And once again, we knew that these stories had to be gathered quickly because of the aging population. All of that, you know, we just started looking at memorabilia, people who brought items to the Little One Room School that was in the school in the 1950s and 1960s, like the original teacher's desk, some of the desks that the students sat in, pictures and different artifacts. And so we just started gathering this information. And in 1994, October 1994, we had a very suspicious fire and we lost everything. The original desk, furniture, pictures, the old tin plated pictures back in the 1800s, you know, we lost everything. So we really didn't know what we wanted to do. Do we continue or do we just stop and forget about it? Well, you know, going through the rubbish of the fire, we found one thing that wasn't burnt. It was scorched, but it was my great-great-grandmother, Rachel Scott. Death certificate, her birth certificate, her funeral arrangement, and a lock of her hair. And Jill and I said, well, you know, I think Rachel Scott is trying to tell us something because this survived the fire and we just need to move on. So we started back over again. We decided to have what was called a memorabilia night again, where people brought things into the school. And we had what was called story swap sessions, where we would choose a theme and we would have people come in and talk about the theme. Some of the themes were one-room schools. Other things were herbs, remedies. We had this one lady, Hazel was her name, from Puckett's Creek, Virginia, an elderly white lady who could identify any plant or herb in the woods and everything. So with our story swaps and our memorabilia, we started over again. We did the story swaps. And so we started, you know, gathering information again. And we just continued to move forward. We had what was called holiday tradition in the mountains. Actually, it was so large that we had to move it from the Little One Room School to the hall of the United Methodist Church that could hold, 100 people or so. From then, we just started, you know, gathering stories again. And in history, but we actually branched out. We branched out of Southwest Virginia and started reaching out into Eastern Kentucky, Northeast Tennessee, even up to Southern West Virginia. And today we have what is called the Appalachian African American Cultural Center, located in Benton Gap, Virginia. Now, restoring history is just one of the things. It's the main thing. That's our vision and goal, is to capture the history of this population of people. But we have branched out in the past years to what is called the anti-racism workshops that my wife and I and another white couple do. Our goal is to get people to talk. One of my quotes, my original quotes is, we must reveal before we can heal. And so we get people to start talking about race relations. And we have found out that it has really, really been very successful over the years, to the point that we have had it with Congress, members of the Congress. And I think what makes our discussion so much different is we approach it from a grassroots standpoint and not so much from an academic standpoint. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the people who are doing these workshops on the national level from an academic standpoint is wonderful. But sometimes you have to break it down and, as the old saying goes, put it to where the goats can get it to understand it. And I think we have a way of bringing it into a safe environment and a very comfortable environment to get people to start talking about race relations.
Yes, I agree. And I had the pleasure of visiting the Appalachian African American Cultural Center. And it's just wonderful what you and your wife, Jill, are doing.
Thank you. 30 plus years of work into it. And hopefully, you know, we can continue. We are getting older, of course. We really don't know the future of the center. You know, I do have two children, but Kevin and Alexis, but they don't live here. Our son is an attorney up in the D.C. area, and our daughter is a school psychologist living over in the Bristol, Virginia area. So I don't see them coming back and running the center. So hopefully our goal is to try to find a university that will, you know, work with us and see the importance of what we have captured over the past 30 plus years.
Oh, yes, definitely. Because it does. It needs to continue. I agree. So, Ron, how are the Melungeon people a part of Black Appalachian history?
Well, you know, my first encounter, and I really didn't know this until several years later, I can recall sitting in that little one-room school in 1964. I believe, 63, 64. And the reason I remember that, because it was around the same time that President Kennedy was assassinated, 63, 64. And these two white men in suit and ties come walking in that little one-room school with about 8 to 10 kids with them. And, you know, I'm sitting there and along with 20 plus other African-American kids. And, you know, we knew very little about diversity. We knew very little about other ethnic groups. You know, we may have knew a little bit about Mexicans, but that's about it. But we knew these kids didn't look like us. And we knew that they wasn't white. And so we really didn't have any idea, you know, why they were coming up to our little one-room school. But moving forward, moving ahead, is that the school system, the Lee County school system, wouldn't admit these kids to the white school during that particular time. And it was because they didn't view them as being white. I look at my great-great-grandmother, Rachel Scott, on her birth certificate. There's like three different things on there. They got mulatto, they have Melungeon, they have Negro. So come to find out, after speaking to, after I moved back here in the 80s and getting to know Brent Kennedy, and Brent was very instrumental in how we structured the Cultural Center back then. He was one of the first advisory board members of the Cultural Center. And just listening to him and the research that he had done, and made me want to go back and research my family. And I found out that, yes, I do have Melungeon in my side of the family. And after becoming part of the 400 Years of African American History Commission, and this digging a little bit deeper, you know, it is my belief, and I'm not sure why you guys are the experts, but I'm under the assumption that Melungeon could be a tri-racial group of people. And, you know, they could be white, they could be African-American, they could be Native American. And just have your genes, I think, picks up. Yeah, that was my first experience of seeing someone who I really couldn't identify as Black or white back in the early 60s.
Yes, you're exactly right, Ron. The Melungeon people were multi-ethnic, multicultural. They were a mosaic of cultures, you know, very blended, exactly. So it was really hard to identify them in a racial construct, right? One of the things said about the Melungeon people is they were too black to be white, too white to be black.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
No, I said exactly. I agree 100%. Yes.
And I do know that during your presentation at the conference this past June, you mentioned a gentleman by the name of Walter Plecker. Now, the name Walter Plecker has been mentioned throughout our three seasons of Melungeon Voices podcast.
We have his papers at the Cultural Center, letters that he has written, totally, totally racist. In 1930, we have an original letter was written to the, I wish I had it here with me at the beach and I could refer to it. But the vital statistics, I believe, saying that there was a group of people in Lee County that's trying to pose as white. They are definitely are not white. They appear to be of Negro origin. They come from an area called Newman Ridge, Tennessee, and they are obviously of a lower class of people. And we really need to put them in their place. And it just goes on and on and on. So reviewing his papers and his letters, I mean, he was a very, very mean man.
Yes, he was.
To put it, you know, lightly, he was someone that didn't believe in race mixing.
Exactly. I remember you did read, Carmen actually read one of his letters.
And yes.
And I know when you mention the name Walter Plecker in any Melungeon communities, it's immediately they get upset. You know, it's like, oh, Walter Plecker. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I saw the reaction to people there in the audience that day.
Ron, can you tell the story about coal miners and the disease of black lung and your role in advocating for coal miners in the black lung cases?
Sure. Heather, I spent over 30 years advocating for coal miners actually across the nation. It started that I opened this clinic up in St. Charles, Virginia called the Black Lung Clinic in 1990. Our goal at that time were to help coal miners to have a better quality of life from a respiratory or pulmonary standpoint. But at the same time, we wanted to try to secure benefits that the miners may be entitled to. Because during this time, and still to this day, I'm told, attorneys will not take any federal black lung claims simply because they can't generate revenue from these claims as quickly as they do with Social Security claims and everything. So I went on a path to learn as much as I could about black lung, or the medical term is co-workers pneumoconiosis. So moving forward, now I will go back. In 2018, I was recognized on the congressional floor of the Senate and the House of Representatives by Congress for the work that I had done over the years for the miners. And they had estimated that I've seen over 250,000 coal miners during that particular time. And right before I retired, my office discovered the highest concentrated rate of PMF, which is progressive massive fibrosis, ever recorded in scientific literature. We had 8 to 10 epidemiologists from NIOSH, which is the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, come to St. Charles, Virginia and live there for months, if not a year, to conduct the study. So they did x-rays of all miners that in our service area. And we particularly service Southwest Virginia, Southern West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, we had miners from over the whole country coming to our clinic because we were known by HRSA, which is the our funding source of the federal government, as the premier Black lung clinic in the nation. We had miners from Wyoming drive in a 15-passenger van just to come to our clinic to be tested for Black lung. In saying that, we discovered this disease, PML, progressive myelofibrosis, and miners were dying at a much younger age. When I first started doing Black lung back in the 90s, the average age of a miner with complicated co-worker pneumoconiosis, or PML, was it around 60, 65, maybe even 70. Because what it is the size of the lesions that grows in your lungs. And the smaller the opacity or nodular in your lung is called co-worker pneumoconiosis. But the larger that it gets, size of a nickel, in some cases size of a quarter, then it is complicated co-worker pneumoconiosis or PML, progressive massive fibrosis. And we started seeing miners in their 20s, 25, 30 years of age being diagnosed by pulmonologists, by B readers who are board certified radiologists diagnosing this. So we knew something was going on in the area. So we got a hold of Burkus. He did a story, and the story just ballooned all over the whole country. That we had identified this terrible cluster of PML for coal miners. And I think our office, we identified a little over 1,200, and that's unheard of for complicated Black lung. Now, simple co-worker pneumoconiosis, we would see those on a regular basis, but complicated was something that we had started seeing in 2017, and it just balloon in 2018. So we got published in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, for identifying this terrible disease. Now, benefits is really hard to prove for coal miners, and this is why attorneys won't usually look at a Black lung case, simply because it's so much work. There's three factors that you have to prove. The first factor is you have to prove that the miner is a miner within the meaning of the act. And the definition of a coal miner with the Department of Labor is anyone who has worked in or around coal where a coal has been extracted from the earth and before this coal is washed and cleaned and placed in the stream of commerce, which means that your work had to be integral to the extraction of the coal coming out of the ground. It couldn't be at a coal tipple after the coal is washed and clean, or a railroad moving the coal to a coal yard or anything. That's the first thing. The second thing is you have to show that the miner suffers from co-worker pneumoconiosis or Black lung disease. And the way that we used to test that and still do is through chest x-rays, CT scans, or MRIs. And once again, you know, I'm not a physician and I'm not an expert in saying this under no means, but your lungs are in three zones, the upper, middle, and lower lobes. And these nodules and opacities actually form on your lungs. And the third thing, and this is the hardest thing to prove at all, is that you have to prove total disability from a respiratory or pulmonary standpoint, which means that you are not able to go back and work due to Black lung, not no back injury, not anything else, but strictly from Black lung has totally disabled you. And the way that we measure disability is through the pulmonary function studies test and the arterial blood gas studies. And the pulmonologist and the respiratory tech would put the miner on the treadmill, and they would do what is called an ABG, arterial blood gas study, where they would stick the miner in the arm or in the wrist, and they would get the heart rate up to a certain level. Then they would draw the blood, and it gives off this number. On the PFT, it's the FEV1, and the respiratory tech can tell you that that's the amount of air you can take in and push back out. The blood gas is totally different. You look at what is called the PO2 that this number gives off. And anything 60 and below is considered totally disabled. Now you think 40% of your breathing has to be gone before you can be considered totally disabled. Now, if you have complicated black lung or progressive massive fibrosis, that automatically disable you. You don't have to have those numbers in order to be disabled. But once again, we our office started in Southwest Virginia. We started winning these cases left and right, not being attorneys. We were just lay advocates, lay representatives going into the administrative law judge hearings in actually federal court. The law states that you can do that and not be a licensed attorney. So I was the only lay representative in the early 90s. And then I've trained people around the country. I trained Linda Glagola up in Washington, Pennsylvania. I trained a couple of ladies and gentlemen out in Raton, New Mexico. We trained at Billings, Montana, Sheridan, Wyoming, Kentucky, Illinois. So we became the guru of federal black lung benefits across the nation.
Wow, that is just amazing. I want to thank you so much for all your hard work and advocacy for coal miners. My great grandfather was a coal miner and he had black lung. You know, so that, you know, personally for me, that means so much.
One thing I want to mention too before we talk about black lung is in 2016, one of the biggest laws, legislation that was changed was in the Byrd Amendments that was hidden in the Affordable Health Care Act that Obama sent out. What it did was it made it easier for the widows, because up until that point, if a minor had black lung and was receiving his benefits and he would die of a heart attack or get hit by a car, the widow was not entitled to these benefits. And I can't begin to tell you how many widows I have cried with, sat down with, because they had to choose between buying their medicine or buying food to eat because they didn't have that income anymore that the minor that they were living on. So with the Byrd Amendments, if a minor has black lung and is receiving benefits at the time of his or her death, then the widow now is automatically entitled to these benefits. And that's a lot of work that we did legislating this before I retired.
That is awesome, Ron. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Ron, just to wrap up, how can our listeners learn more about the Appalachian African American Cultural Center and support the organization's wonderful work?
Yes, you can go to our website at AAACC.org, or you can go to AAACulturalCenter.org, which stands for the Appalachian African American Cultural Center.org, or you can give us a call at 276-546-5144. You know, call us up. We'd be more than happy to do tours. The center has partnered with actually a couple of organizations that are doing stories in Appalachia. We have partnered with the Origin Project, which is Adrienne Trigiani, who wrote the Big Stone Gap movie. Her organization, we have partnered with her, and we are doing some work with the Appalachian Stories Project, which is a group that Amy Clark, who's a professor up at UVAY, is doing. So, but yes, anytime you're in the area and want to come by the cultural center, and I make it very clear that we are not a museum. We do have artifacts in there, but we are not a museum. We are an education and research center. And hopefully that, you know, we can have a good conversation.
Well, Ron, I just want to thank you so much for being on our podcast. And I look forward to working more with the Appalachian African American Cultural Center in the future.
Yes. And I think I failed to mention that I would love for the center and Heather and your organization. I just love for us to continue our relationship and the work that we are doing. Definitely crossover.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Ron.
Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Melungeon Voices podcast. On behalf of myself, Heather Andalina, and the entire MHA Executive Committee, we'd like to thank all of those who participated in making this episode possible. For more information, you can visit them on the web at melungeon.org. That's melungeon.org. The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast episode do not necessarily represent those of the MHA. Melungeon Voices is presented by the Melungeon Heritage Association. All rights are reserved.